Our next speaker is R. Emmett Turrell, Jr., nationally syndicated columnist, author, and editor-in-chief of the American Spectator. Bob.
Well, listening to this intellectual debate makes me even more anti-intellectual than I was when I came in here. You know, in Aristotle's Ethics, he speaks very glowingly of the importance of friendliness. And I certainly would like to have seen more of it here. I'm delighted to be in the presence of so many old friends and old enemies, I guess. And glad to see people here that I've grown up with and to some degree growing old with. When we began here, when I began here some 15 years ago, this truly was an embattled minority. In some ways, it's no longer an embattled minority. In some ways, we're the majority. We've won the hearts, if not the minds, of the American people. And it must be terribly frustrating to all of us to know, if we do recognize it, as we should recognize it, that we've won the hearts, if not the minds, of the American people, but are as much today an embattled minority in the world of ideas as ever before. And perhaps we're even more of an embattled minority. Because whether you recognize it or not, those same liberals who found us sort of charming in the late 70s now have become desperate, and they're really out to get us. Now, I don't know how many of you people have published in national forums or appeared in national forums. It might not matter to you. But those who have are having a terribly tough time of it out there. And I think, really, it's important for us to remember that we are in the oddest of historical conditions, a condition in which, for a democracy, the majority of the American people favor our positions, but the America that matters far out of proportion to its numbers, the American intelligentsia, second-rate and third-rate though they are out to get you, and in many ways they have gotten you. They have barred you. They have discredited you. The people they've done the best number on recently are the neoconservatives. The neoconservatives are, in my opinion, in danger right now of sinking beneath the vituperative that has been directed at them by the consensus intelligentsia. I won't call them liberal because they aren't liberal. I called them New Age liberal in my last book, and I think that that term ought to stick. And they'll believe in New Ages until they die. They're forever seeing new dawns and forever seeing new enthusiasms, and apparently, much to my surprise in recent years, failing to see the intelligence of the criticism that has been raised against them starting years ago here at the Philadelphia Society. And I would have thought that that would be the kind of thing that we should be directing ourselves against. One of the many, we live in a country that's incredible, you know. I've used to travel 240 miles to come to this meeting every year, and now that I've moved to Washington, I've traveled 2,450 miles, it seems, farther than ever before, because Washington seems so far from the American Midwest and the American mainstream. There really is a beltway mentality, and it really is different than the mentality of the ordinary American people, and it really is pernicious. And that mentality is a mentality that has very successfully barred the conservative point of view and misrepresented the conservative point of view. And it seems to me that that's the point of view that we ought to be devoting all of our energies against. the point of view of the consensus intelligentsia that dominate our media. Imagine that city, that hick town of Washington. And having lived in hick towns for 20-some years, I know what a hick town is, and I'm telling you, Washington is not Paris or London. Having lived in that hick town that actually prides itself in saying it is the most important city in the world, it's astonishing to note that it has 1.5 newspapers right now and is resisting the notion that it'll ever have 2 newspapers. If you go to a kiosk in Washington, D.C., if you can find a kiosk in Washington, D.C., you'll find less of a range of opinion than certainly in any capital in the Western world. The point of view of Ronald Reagan has been misrepresented continually during these years. And I don't think it speaks well for us that we haven't been able to represent Ronald Reagan's point of view in a compelling and intelligent way. I think we should be thinking about directing our attention against this extraordinary threat to what ought to be a historical development, and that is the development of Ronald Reagan, the conservative point of view, as the preeminent point of view in our country. There has, in the last couple of years, in my opinion, been a growing listlessness in the conservative critique or the conservative government, and certainly amongst the conservative intelligentsia. And I can speak with some authority on that. I don't know if I'm here as a representative of neoconservatism or conservatism or traditional conservatism or liberal or libertarian conservatism. I can only tell you that as editor of the American Spectator for almost 20 years, so far as I can tell, I've offended all of you. And so far as I can tell you, all of you have offended me in one way or another. But I certainly wouldn't want to publish. You certainly haven't driven me into the liberal camp, I'll have you know. They're certainly more offensive. We ought to be considering, it seems to me, the kind of the thing I talk about, a certain listlessness. Our inability to get through to the American media and to the American Academy and present our point of view. We've failed at this. They have turned their hearts against us more than ever before. In the late 60s, when I first started publishing people who have now come to be called neoconservatives, at least you could say those people had the courage of their convictions. And when they felt that they were out of pace or out of step with the drift of American liberalism, which was, of course, a drift towards radicalism, they at least had the courage to step aside. And I remember so well in those days that a lot of conservatives questioned whether these neocons were really going, whether these liberals were really going to come our way. And in those days, I think they did. What astonishes me, that is, that in the last 5 or 6 years, those liberals who have come to see the light have refused to come our way, have called themselves neoliberals, which is to say, a person that intends to exploit all the wisdom that we in this room have, through bitter experience, brought together, and to advance themselves by assaulting us in public. These are people, these neoliberals, are people that don't have the courage of their convictions. The neoconservatives certainly did, and certainly have come a long way with us. I think in many ways you're drawing a distinction without a difference when you make this distinction between neoconservatives and neoliberals. I remember when I first met the Crystals, how astonished I was to see that the Crystal children were more conservative than I was, and still are more conservative than I am, though I'm trying to get them to become a little more latitudinarian. I, in essence, and to come to my final point, or to reiterate my point, I find this all a futile exercise that reminds me very much of the kinds of exercises that I see liberals participating in. It's the liberals that have excelled in misrepresenting your point of view. And this morning I thought Paul Gottfried sounded to me like a liberal in misrepresenting the point of view of neoconservatives. He always managed to leave just a little something out. And at the end of his discourse, if indeed everything he said was accurate about the neoconservatives, well, I think everybody in the room has got to admit that these neoconservatives are idiots and scoundrels. The difference, of course, is that the problem is that he, as with so many liberal polemicists, simply misrepresented the case, just simply misrepresented the positions of people like Susan Garman. It would be a terrible thing, after all the effort that's been put into our point of view by so many of us, if we lost the ball game because we wanted to, typical of intellectuals, in our narcissism and grandiosity, sit around preening our nails, talking about our own intellectual purity, and not get on with the task of taking on the real enemies of our country and our civilization. And they aren't even, as I say, liberals anymore. They're infantile radicals. There's nothing quite like them in the world. I don't think there's anything quite like them in the world. I don't want to exaggerate. But there is no country quite like this in the Western world. A country without, at the highest levels of its discourse, without the organs or an intellectual class to take on the liberal class. Let me put it differently. At the highest level of our society, we do not see the diversity that you'll find in Paris or in London. We don't have the Times and the Telegraph. We don't have the distinguished professors at the London School of Economics and at Oxford representing Tory opinion or conservative opinion in this country that you have over there. We really have an embattled minority that's been very successfully barred from American media and from the American universities. The people that have barred us, that have practiced intellectual intolerance, muzzy-headed thinking, and hypocrisy writ large, are the enemies of the American Republic. They're our enemies, and they're the people that we ought to take on. And in as much as we continue to fail in that battle, I think it's a failure of courage on our behalf. I think it's very easy to take on one another, but let's take on the real bullies and the real menace to the Republic, and those, in my opinion, those are the liberals, and I welcome you to join us all in the battle to take them on. Thank you.